Thank you, Mary. How's everybody doing?
Someone pass me my cup. It's water, I promise.
Thank you. If you notice, I'm running around a little more frantic than usual. It's because we're shorthanded. Robbie's in Salt Lake City. And so doing the, y'all can giggle, y'all can laugh. I mean, I wasn't, he's okay. So I'm doing the AV as well as getting this thing kicked off. But again, shout out to our sponsors, Texas Memphis Listening Lab, for having us here, for partnering with us on this experience this year. Thanks, Mary and Liv, for being my rocks. But thank you, Robbie. Well, he's not here. Yeah, thank you all for being here. Stereo Sessions was the third one of the season thus far this year. Who's been to everyone this season? Except one. Okay. Who's here for the first time? Great. Well, welcome. So this experience has been amazing over the past several years. We're almost to 5 years of the station being here. And this is one of our sort of flagship initiatives. You know, it's a seminar. It's a listening experience. It was really, I think, even more revolutionary for the time that we started it, because we were pretty much in the pandemic, coming out of the pandemic. The idea of sitting together listening to a record was novel for a lot of reasons. Listening to a record the way you might listen to go and see a film, you know, sitting next to someone you may not know and having discussions around it, this sort of thing. So this is also a first for tonight, because I think this is the first time we've had someone back for a stereo session on a subsequent record after we've had them before. And so I won't belabor the introduction. I'll go ahead and introduce and welcome Reverend Charles Edward Hodges. Senior, he's affirmed that that is indeed water, the regular kind of water. Put mine down. Well, you came in hot stepping. I was excited to see you.
I came in running.
So we had you here a few years back to talk about the High Rhythm on the Loose record, but this is a different experience. I'm gonna get you to pull that mic up to you so they can hear. Yeah, because you got some wisdom for. I already know. Every time we get together, you have expert wisdom. You have played on many, many records.
I have.
And you've done many, many things. You've co-written on tons of records. A lot of people, I'm sure if you've read anything about this gentleman, one name that probably popped up, or two names, I'll give you two, Willie Mitchell and Al Green.
Correct.
You are largely responsible for the organ sound, that warm Hammond B3 organ sound that we all probably, you know, heard from the cradle all the way to now, and we'll continue to hear for many, many years. As long as ears are listening to soul music, your sound will be alive. And so we're honored that you're here with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure being here with you all.
But tonight, I thought it would be special to bring you back without the rest of the band, without your brother Leroy, without Hubby, and, when we had planned to do the High Rhythm record the first time, when we started out on the season, Howard Grimes was still with us. And unfortunately, when we got to the record, he was no longer with us. Right. So we want to remember him as well. We also want to remember Al Jackson Jr.
Right.
And the many, many other people that you all played with. I mean, my cousin Andrew Love.
Right.
Tons, and James Mitchell, and Jack Hill. And, I mean, just so many more. Wayne Jackson. So many more that deserve the acknowledgement for the music that came out of the Royal Recording Studio and High Records. I thought it'd be an interesting way to get into this O.B. Wright record, to hear your story, because your history with O.B. Wright goes further back even your history playing with your brothers.
Correct.
And so I'd love for you to just tell us your journey. And bring us, we're going to bring it up to this record, and then we're going to go far and beyond this record. But tell me, who is before you were the Reverend, who is Charles Edward Hodges, and where were you born, and how did you begin playing? Because I know your father played piano, too, right?
Right. Late Leroy Hodges Sr. Charles Hodges, he was born in Germantown. My mom and dad, Leroy and Rosalie, they had 11 children. They had four sets of twins. They had three sets in a row that survived. And the last of fourth would have been four sets, but one of the ones the doctor had to just take, you know, it was an ultimatum, the mother of the babies. So everybody chose the mother, I'm sure, because she survived it. But again, they had seven kids in 4 years, nine kids in 6 years, and went on and had 11. And out of those children, Leroy, the bass player, he's still with us. He's the one did all the recording with me, along with, you know, with Maven Tilly. He's deceased since 2014. He was the lead guitar player, and I was the piano player. But later on, I switched over to organ. And again, born in Germantown, and that was home, Germantown. The mayor gave the Hodges the privilege of having a Hodges Day on September the 26th every year. So we came through some things, but nothing was wasted. God blessed us.
Even your siblings who were not in the band later on were musical, I read in your book. And you played tons of instruments, or you did growing up. You kind of bounced around until you really found your thing. I mean, I take it, again, your father was musical. What level of attention was that destiny for you to make sure that you grew to be a musician with so much music in your home? Was that something that you really took ownership of from a young age?
I did. My dad brought a piano in. I was 11 years old, but he had one. We had a house fire, and it burned the whole house down along with the piano. I was used to listening to it because he always played it. But when I turned 11 years old, he brought a piano home. Excuse me. And when he got on that piano, I heard this, that's the sound I used to hear when I was growing up. And when he got off of it, I got on it, started banging on it. My dad didn't bother me for a whole year. My mama used to run her crazy, get off of it. But my dad, he figured that I had to find my way. So one day, I was in the living room, piano was in the living room, and I was trying to play a line, and I was hitting the wrong note. My dad came out of his bedroom. He said, "Charles, how did you play that?" And I showed him. He stood over my shoulder. I said, "No, to play it like this." And that's what it is. Like,
now, it's interesting to me that you and your brothers kind of on different journeys as far as becoming professionals in music. I mean, amateur, professional, whichever the case. You played in several bands before you really locked in with your brothers. Your brothers kind of got caught in the Willie Mitchell orbit on their own. Right. And you, some kind of way, ended up with O.B. Wright. Well, I know a bit of the story. I read it in different books, but we're going to hear from you tonight how y'all sort of got apart and came back together. Could you break down from the different bands you played in as a young person with your friends?
Yes. A group called the Style Setters. Leroy and Teeny were playing with a group called the Umbrellas. So I went with a group, some of my schoolmates, called the Style Setters. And then we later changed it to the Esquires. And Flamingo Group was the most popular club in the city. And Willie Mitchell was in there first. Then Gene Bowley Miller, after he left, then the Impellers, and then my group. We went in after that. But that was just really, I was kind of getting myself together, but I played with a white group. I can't remember the name of it, but it was on Gidwell. And my dad used to carry me from Germantown to practice. And then when I had to work, we worked 6 nights a week. And I was like about 14 years old. And he would carry me to work and pick me up. And so one day, I was in the 10th grade, and I heard a knock on the door. And some guys wanted to rehearse at the house. I was going to Mount Pisgah in Cordova, and was a talent show coming up, and O.B. Wright was going to be the special guest. O.B. Wright went to Mount Pisgah as well. So we got some songs together, and come the night of the talent show, when O.B. got there, his guitar player, which was my cousin, I found out later on, Melvin Carter, he got lost. So after we finished, O.B. asked me, he said, do you know any of my songs? I said, I know all of your songs. What kids you gonna make me cry in? And see what kids, Monkey Dog and D, gone for good and L. I told him all the keys. He said, well, do you know him? I said, I know him. So we went in the locker room, and the piano in there. Well, he had me to play him for. He said, man, will you do my show with me tonight if my guitar player don't show up? I'm saying to myself, Lord, I hope he show up. But he didn't. And anyway, they called O.B. Wright out, and O.B. called me out and told him that I was one of the students he had at Mount Pisgah, and his guitar player got lost, so I was going to do it with him. And it happened. And after the show, he asked me, he said, when you get out of school, I want you to go on the road with me. I said, yeah, right. Just like that. Okay. So, but I got to tell this. This is one of my fame parts of it. After that concert, that was on a Friday, I didn't too much have a problem getting girls, you know, dating girls, you know, at that young age. But after that, every corner, the four corner, you walk one corner and I had another walk to the next corner. It was like that. And from that day to this day, those people are still my fans. They know everything about my history, my career. And Mount Pisgah was an unusual school because it was a highly ed spiritual school. Cersei Harris was the principal. And I was just brought up like that, not only at home, but in school as well. But one night I was rehearsing at the Flamingo Room, and it was that night, and they had the lights on, and I heard a voice say, hey, is your name Charles Hodges? And I said, yeah. I said, who are you? He said, O.B. Wright. I said, yeah, right. So the lead singer, the manager of the group, Columbus Thomas, he said, no, that's O.B., that's my cousin. So he came on, and sure enough, it was him. So he said, are you out of school? I said, I'm out of school. He said, you ready to go? I said, go where? He said, you told me you were going to travel with me when you got out of school. I said, man, I thought you was joking. He said, no, I wasn't joking. So I said, well, I'm still living in Germantown with my mom and dad. I have to now go out there and see if it's okay. So he said, well, come on, I'll follow you. I said, I don't have a car. He said, well, come on, me and my wife will take you out there. So they carried me to Germantown. And when I walked in the house, my dad said, Charles, what are you doing at home? You're supposed to be at rehearsal. I said, I got scared, dude. My dad was strict. He did not play. He took you at your word. If you told him something, he expected you to do it. But anyway, I said, O.B. Wright brought me home. He won't ask you a question. He said, O.B. Wright. And my mom, she jumped this high and started hollering and screaming. So anyway, they come in, and I introduced him to O.B. So O.B. told him they wanted me to go on the road with him. And Dad said, well, you got to kind of watch him, kind of hothead. O.B. said, well, I'll take care of him. Dad said, well, if you don't mind you, just send him home. Just like that. So that's how I got with O.B. Wright over there in 67. And I toured with him up until I got with a Willie.
You know, I want to make sure that we take some time to try to qualify this time and this place and how big a star O.B. Wright was. in this universe of Memphis and the surrounding areas and this region. Let me see if I could find a way for you. I wasn't there. I was born in 1993. My birthday's Monday, so we can have, drink more water. But I guess what you were a big fan of Ray Charles when you first started playing the piano, right?
Definitely. I went to see him a couple of times in Memphis. I was on the age, around 16 or so, but the club owners knew me, you know, from playing. So they would let me go into places like a hippodrome, you know, different places. But they say, okay, you can't sit at the table. You're going to have to stay over here close to the bar. If the police come in, you're up here, you know. So I agree with that. But I got to see a lot of the people like Ray Charles, Hank Crawford, and, you know, some of the big people, Etta James. Matter of fact, I had an opportunity to perform with her. I was about 16 and 17 at the club called Paradise. Yeah, but like I said, I was blessed. I know this was my destiny, and God showed it was, but you know, a prophet is someone that it simply tells something and it comes to pass. My eighth grade teacher was a prophet, and she told me that I was going to do this. I was going to travel around the world, and people, you know, and I was wasn't going to be out of a dime unless I wanted to buy something. I couldn't see it at that time, but anyway, that did happen. Yeah.
Can we in some way measure Wright's popularity? You know, this is before, you know, American Bandstand, or, you know, this is a guy that you may not have seen in many photographs of, but his voice was well known, not only in this emerging genre of soul, but he was a big star in gospel. He was a big star in blues, and in some kind of way was able to cross over into all those realms. And people loved him for it. I mean, could you explain it further?
Yes, O.V., he started off a singing gospel. He won a scholarship from Mount Pisgah. He went to, what is this college? Russ College. He won a four-year scholarship in music. And that's how he really got started. When he got out, he went with a company called Bagby, Don Roby. In Houston, Texas. That's where he did the recording with the Sunset Traveler, the lead singer with Sunset Traveler. And his big song was Jesus' Program. That was a big hit. So after that, he went into the R&B field. And he cut You Gonna Make Me Cry. Did that on 8 Men and 4 Women, you know, all those songs. But as far as me telling you, y'all never saw him perform, you all would probably sit in y'all's seat and call me a lie. But I told it to Willie Mitchell, the late Willie Mitchell. I told it to Teeny Leroy, my brother, what I had witnessed him doing down at a Mississippi State College. When we got there, it was raining. Ambulances, about 10 or 12 ambulances lined up beside the building. And I said, hey, man, I said, what are all these ambulances doing here? He said, you'll see. That's all he said, you'll see. And sure enough, Robert Parker, he had the record out Barefoot. So O.V. didn't have a record at the time. You're the number one record. But O.V. and Robert Parker started discussing who's going to open the show. So Robert Parker said, hey, man, said, I'm the star. Obi said, okay. Are you sure this is what you want? Okay, so we did 2 shows. And we got started, did Obi stuff, and we played, we bagged Robert Parker. But at the last half, Robert Parker got it. I can't go on after this guy. So Robert Parker, I'm going on first. Obi said, no, man, you can't do that. He said, no, man, I'm going on first. So anyway, Obi said, go ahead. But to tell the story. I never seen it. I traveled with him for 8 or 9 months. But this particular night, he was singing, and he set the mic on the stand, and he'd pick his fingernails, old hand, just do his fingernails like that. And he sang, I saw women, men fall out face first on concrete and hardwood floor. And when they got him up with not any blood anywhere, I told Willie and Teeny and Flip, quote, quote, what I witnessed, they didn't believe it. So we did a concert at the Coliseum, and Willie said, well, I tell you what, after the show, you bring OV over to Manhattan. We went to Manhattan. Not OV didn't go. He used the band because I was talking about the band because he knew OV, right? So I told him what had happened. So anyway, OV did a concert at Paradise. And Willie said, well, I'm coming. I'm not with Willie yet. I'm still with OV, right? We get out there. They lined up. Did the same thing. He was someone everyone should have heard singing. He was unbelievable, and no one, no R&B artist wanted to go on the stage behind OV Wright. I don't know if you ever heard that or not, but that's the God's truth. No one wanted to go on behind OV Wright. He was just that great.
There was a name in there that I want to make sure that we don't pass over before we get into the record, and I want to get more in this conversation because the record's impeccable. You can stream the record or you can grab a copy, but this is living history that we deserve. We're honored by these stories that we can continue this oral history. But Don Roby is the character who fascinates me. And I think that it's important that we talk about him in Duke Peacock Records and this sort of push and pull between Memphis and Houston in order to set up the transition of OV working with Don Roby and kind of spiritually going on with the Royal Studios and with the High label. You're the first person I've been able to ask point blank about him. Things that I've read about him was that he was a gangster. I mean, a gangster guy with a record label, which is not uncommon in any way. And there's a lot of overlap in those worlds. But, he helped to make Bobby Blue Bland a big recording star right. on the Duke label. I understand that he had some hand in B.B. King's early work. Right. I should not be paraphrasing with Robert Gordon in the room, but I'm going to look up to make sure that I'm not off base here. But this Backbeat label that he had, Carlton was on there. There were some other people who recorded for Backbeat. I mean, do you remember what Don Roby was like and what was his relationship like with Willie Mitchell for him to allow OV to do 2 records here in Memphis while still under contract with Backbeat and eventually OV does come all the way over to Willie's label?
Yeah, well, Don, I got to meet him and in 67, I went out in Houston, Texas and OV, I was traveling with him then and he was recording the Mighty Clouds of Joy that day when I went in. They were one of the most famous gospel groups ever, Joe Lagon. But anyway, Don Roby, he appeared to me to be a businessman, and didn't anyone mess with it. That's one thing, but you could have been a gangster. A whole lot of times we don't want to know things. You think you want to know, but a whole lot of times, it's better not known than known. But OV and Willie had a relationship, and Willie always has been a master of voices, and he wanted OV Wright's voice, and he used to make him offers, come on over there, we'll be recording, OV would come in, and we recorded, and OV really wanted to come because he was having problems getting his royalties from Don Roby. That's the main reason he came over with, over to High Label. And they worked out a deal, and Willie bought the contract. And when he bought the contract, he bought the catalog as well. So what we did, we recorded all the songs that Don Robey had recorded and pulled his in. So the records that was selling were the records that High Rhythm had recorded with Willie Mitchell on O.V. Wright up until, I started doing some writing with him, and we just moved on from there.
It was tough for me to choose between this record, Memphis Unlimited, and Nickel and a Nail, which is the one that y'all did just prior, also produced by Willie Mitchell, still on the Backbeat label. Do you have any thoughts about the differences between those two records or any memories of that time period, cutting, getting, one, reunited with your brothers through this partnership between Robey, Wright, and Mitchell, but just the energy of that kind of homecoming?
Oh man, that was really super. I kind of remember that almost as it was last night. But when we started recording, we started in the daytime, started recording some of the selection in the day. But Nickel and a Nail, we did that one at night, and we were just sitting there. We wanted to do something different, a little different from what Don wrote. Or he used a lot of minor. You know, all through the song, we figured with this voice, we're going to have to use some minor keys in order to get O.V. right, since he's saying gospel. So we did that Nickel and a Nail, and that was a big record for him, and it was just never looked back with him.
I'll ask this last question, and then we'll jump into it, because you mentioned Willie Mitchell as the master of voices, but this is pre Al Green's huge success. I believe he might have already been around.
Yeah.
And it's after Willie was unable to really find success with taking Don Bryan off the stage and putting him on the record. Don Bryan, Mr. Rhythm, as they called him, was a huge, huge success here locally on stage, a draw, an attraction. I mean, like almost like, you know, Ringling Brothers. I mean, like people wanted to see this man on stage.
Right.
But unfortunately, that did not necessarily translate to a record. And as we know, you know, it took several decades for him to be able to find his voice on record, which is the remarkable thing about his career.
Mm-hmm.
So to this point, if I could push back on you, Willie Mitchell had not had a vocalist that he had had great success with.
Right.
Was that in your mind at all?
When he got Ann Peebles, But Don, we just couldn't. We had some records did good on sale, but he never had any big hits. But Don, he didn't stop. He became a hell of a writer, because Don had been Willie Mitchell there since he was 12 years old, he and his brothers. Willie knew what he could do, but he just couldn't. He couldn't find anyone to write him anything to do what he really needed done in order to keep the company going. So when he got Al Green, that was the key. And then they started coming in. We had a chance to sign Luke Hilton, ZZ Hero, a whole bunch of the blues stars, but they were paying so much attention to Al Green at that time. They didn't want any parts of it. But along with Al Green, and the one that we did record with Detroit Impulse, and so on, we recorded 26 gold and platinum rolls consecutive in a row. And that really opened the door. And then we had people come in like Rod Stewart, Bob Skaggs, had an opportunity to record with these people, Keith Richards of the Rolling Stone, that recorded him, and many more. Marissa Edwards, I did a song, Paul Rogers. But that brought it in, that opened the door, but Don Bryan just couldn't get anything on.
I've been searching
right. What y'all think about Side A? Feel good with it? Y'all kind of see what I'm talking about, right? You hear what you hear that classic high, that high rhythm sound, that Royal Studio sound. But there's a grittiness and a savvy and a there's an aged texture to Obi Wright's sound, and that fluidity of being able to do soul blues, but like the great soul men of that time, I mean, you can tell he comes straight from the church.
He did straight from the church.
Could you tell me a bit about his personality? Because reading between the lines, photos I've seen of him, you know, a picture of him taken 2 years apart, he might look like two different people. Of what I've read of him, that, you know, addiction did cripple him some, and it looked like it might have impacted his appearance, but also
it didn't affect his voice.
Yeah. What was his demeanor like from day to day?
One of the greatest guys you ever want to be around. He didn't put himself up on a pedestal. He was just down to earth. Whatever you like, if you want to eat a hot dog for lunch, hey man, that's what I want, you know. I mean, he was just down to earth. Really nice guy to be with. He became to be as close as a brother. And that's on the career side. He was a great guy. Great guy. I miss him. I hate what happened to him, but he was just living too fast, and he was working too hard. And at a certain point in this business, you are turned to something, for a crutch, and he used the drugs. And there was this downfall, the drug, what got him. But even during all that time, he was just as humble as you or I.
Thank you. I appreciate you calling me humble. Thank you. Really kind.
You are. You come to me that way.
Well, what was it like reuniting with your brothers and finding that groove? I'm not familiar if this was the first record that you were sort of welcomed to what was becoming the official high rhythm section. How did that reunion take place?
I got with Willie in 67, and Teenie and Leroy were already with him. But how I got with Willie, O.B. Wright would go back, you know, when he got back in town, he would head straight to the studio, because O.B. lived about 3 or 4 or 5 doors from the studio. And he would tell Willie what was going on with me out on the road. And when Willie would tell Teenie, Teenie said, "Charles don't know how to play no piano." Because he hadn't heard in a long time, you know. But anyway, Willie's a good kid too. So the crowd picked up. I got to the point where it's that O.B. wanted me to open the show. He had a valet guy named Jackie Pettis. He was a vocal singer, and he was opening it. But O.B. wanted me to play some on the organ. I had a little keyboard. And so I would go out, and I would do 2 or 3 songs, then bring Jackie out, and then Jackie would bring O.B. out on stage. And that went over real good. And when I got with Willie, we were that Manhattan. So Willie rehearsed on Tuesday. He was working 6 nights a week. And Willie said, "Hey, guys," said, "what about this? Say, Charles, the way he played, say, it's different than the way we play. Say, but they love the way he played." Like that. Say, "How about us taking it on the road?" So they said, "Okay." So anyway, that's how that came about. And that's when we jailed. During that, they kind of got behind my style of playing. And Willie gave the nickname, "Do Funny." He said, "I did funny things on the organ." But that's how we got together. When we started recording, we decided to come off of the route. At a certain point, we had a couple of accidents. Well, we flipped over one time in Topeka, Kansas, heading to Fort Riley, Kansas, and we had a bad accident. No one killed. Willie had a broken leg and an ankle. James Mitchell, the driver, he was driving. He got about 17 stitches. His head knocked the windshield out. We turned over three times. And they called the radio station in Memphis and said that we all were killed, that we were dead. So when I called my wife. I just got married. And she's calling and crying. She didn't know it was me. I said, what are you crying about? And then she started hollering and screaming when she got my voice. She said, they buy enough plane tickets to bring us out there to claim your old body. Well, anyway, that didn't happen. But we did another one. We had four blowouts before we were heading to do a Joey Bishop show, Dick Clark, Bald City, going out to do the TV shows. We had already done Hee Haw. We did Hee Haw, stopped in Memphis, then we're going out in California. But we had four blowouts. Pow, 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 pow. So we was heading after that. We went on and made that. And we decided, I'm coming to your question. We was heading to Macon, Georgia. That's where I did the first concert with O.V. Wright in Macon, Georgia. But we was here to Macon, Georgia. Willie said, hey, guys. Said, we've been having some rough time on this road. He said, what about us just going in the studio, recording, and leave the room alone? Everybody said, yeah. So everybody wanted it. So we made that agreement. We did the Macon, Georgia concert and came back and laid it down. We stopped traveling. So it was a club called Curious Manhattan on Thomas. That's where a high rhythm would play to stay tight. You know, we were recording something like almost every day. But on the weekend, we'd go in there, we'd try new things, and that's how we really, you know, began to feel each other. I knew what the bass player was going to do. He knew what I was going to do. The guitar player knew what everyone was going to do, and the drama, and that's how it all came.
Listening to that side, you know, spoilers, the record before this has A Nickel and a Nail, has these other, you know, songs that kind of talk about superstition, and it has Ace of Spades. And he references that previous record. And you kind of were giggling and responding to different things that were being sung and said when you listen to side A. Tell me about that repertoire, that new sound, that new leap for O.V. Wright, and what comes to mind when you were listening?
Well, I could seem like I was just there. You know, I was doing it at this particular time. And I was just really listening to all the instruments, what they were doing, and then what I was doing, and how it all just came together, and what O.V. was saying, how everything just tied in to make that make that thing to be a whole thing.
There's a lot of humor on the side of the record, too. Irony and a lot of different devices going on at once.
Yes, and there's a lot of truth in it, too. In the words, you know, in the words, like, for instance, he's my son, just the same.
Well, that's one thing I want to preach, yes.
Yeah, well, now on that one, O.V. had just gotten out of federal penitentiary, like I said. You know, he had a drug problem. And he did 5 years of federal time. So we were in the studio, had just finished recording, and then all of a sudden the door opened. O.V. Wright. My organ, if you've ever been to a Royal Studio, you got the grand piano when you come through the door, but the organ is the first instrument that is going to be covered there. And he saw me and said, like, he almost started crying. I mean, he was just so glad. See, I jumped up and I ran. We embraced each other. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Man, I was sitting up here thinking about you, believe it or not." He said, "Well, you got a song for me." I said, "Yeah, we got a song for you." So the late Reverend Darrell Carter, he and I did a song, O.V. Wright's Blind, Crippled, and Crazy. We wrote that. So then we did another one, "I Don't Need Nobody But You." And he's talked about getting out of prison, but this song here, "He's My Son Just the Same." He said, "Man," said, "I've just been writing a song," said, "but I don't have the music to it." I said, "Well," I scooted over on the organ stool. I said, "Sit down." I said, "Tell me what you got. Sing it. You know," he said, "Well, I'm going to read the words." He gave me the words. I said, "Okay, let's put some music to it." I just got home, serving my time. There's a baby in the family, you know, and I know he can't be mine. And as he was saying it, I just found the chords and put it together. And that's how it came out.
Building this sound, this Memphis soul sound. There's a lot of different things happening at the time. You know, Gold Wax has a thing going on. You know, Willie had the Home Blues, and now he's at at High. He's taking over the studio from the Coogies. But there's this oh gosh, for lack of a better term, a push and a pull between High and Stax. That's a Rufus Thomas joke. And, you know, a lot of things, a lot of ingredients that might go into Memphis soul. The horns, the backing vocal, the drum beat, which fortunately Al Jackson Jr. had an opportunity to play with both. But let's focus on the organ and let's talk about Booker T and the MGs, Booker T Jones, and you and your brothers and that style and repertoire. Were you paying much attention to what was going on over there? I know you did some work over there. But was there a competition? Was it friendly? Was it what do you make of that and how important it is to the recipe of the soul, that organ and those two bands?
Well, you know, Booker T, he's the guy. But I was with Booker down in Austin, Texas a few years ago at this South by Southwest festival. And, you know, when you're doing something, you feel people are listening, but sometimes you're just really not aware who is listening and at the extent that they're listening. But Booker was on this thing along with High Rhythm. And Booker, we had a rehearsal before, you know, the night before. So Book and I was talking, and I said, "Man," I said, "I met you." He said, "I remember you, Charles. We met, so we never had a, you know, sit down and had a conversation." I said, "Right." So he said, "Well, look here. Let me ask you a question." So you're getting ready to rehearse. He said, "Y'all going to do I Can't Stand the Rain, right? By Ann Peebles." I said, "Right." He said, "Well, do you mind if I come up and stand behind to watch you play it?" I said, "No, come on." So he got up there and we played it. And I looked back and he was just jumping. He was just looking and laughing. He said, "I didn't know what you were doing." He says, "I've been taking a classic music lesson ever since I was 3 years old from his grandmother. She was a music teacher." And he says, "They told me I couldn't play both keyboards at the same time." I said, "Well, they didn't tell me." You know, I learned.
That's why you're do funny.
Yeah, exactly. It's a gift God gave me the ability to do it. And I asked him, he was coming up next. I said, do you mind if I watch you when you do Green Onion? He said, no, come on. I thought I knew how to play Green Onion. He played it. I said, oh, no, I don't know. This guy, man, I'm telling you, man, he's a master. He's a master. But get back to your story between High Records and Stax. One day we were in the studio getting ready to record Al, and they found out we were getting ready to record Al Green. We looked up. Everyone on the staff is in the studio. They coming in the studio. We in there working the song up. You're getting ready to record. Otis Redding, Barcase, Carl Cunningham, James Alexander, all the guys was in the studio. David Porter, Isaac Hayes. And we went through maybe a minute or two of what we were doing, and then all of a sudden everybody was gone. They left. They said they just wanted to see how were we doing. Because, see, Isaac Hayes, we turned out to be just like brothers on the for real side, and David Porter. They told Al, he had, tired of being alone, he got a gold record, but he looked up on one. He ain't gonna get there another one. Came back and did the next one. They getting lucky. He got another, but I bet they don't get another one. And like I told you all earlier, we did 26 gold and platinum consecutive in a row. And that's what brought them in there, to see how we were doing it. But then they still didn't get it. They still didn't get it because we were high risk. We were brothers. We were spiritual brothers, and we were bound to make each other better. Just like the OKC, the basketball team, one make the other one better. You know, we're not trying to outplay anyone. We want to get in our spot and brighten the things up. That's the way we were successful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But I noticed one thing. There is a Stax record that all of y'all played on.
Oh, yeah. Well,
Jimmy McCracken.
Yeah.
Do you remember doing that record?
Yeah. Yes. He came over to High first before we went over to Stax. And I cut so many records at Stax. I did the Soul Children, the Bar King, the Box Tops. I did Little Bills and Walk the Street, the Back Street and Cried. I did that album. I did Johnny Taylor with Al Jackson Jr., Running Out of Lies. Like I said, Rufus Thomas, Carla Thomas, and I did Shirley Brown, the Woman to Woman album. I recorded so much over there. So when we got to where we got the attention, we didn't only get the musicians' attention, we got the owner like Jim Stewart. He was sent for Al Jackson would come over, and we were recording the Detroit M. We recorded six golden platinum then. And, excuse me. So Jim Stewart wanted me to come over and do some stuff with Johnny Taylor. And I did about two or three albums, you know, along with him. And I did quite a bit of work on that stuff.
I want to jump into this second side of the record because I don't want to hold everybody through the evening. And we definitely want to be good stewards and good neighbors to our friends down the hall here at Memphis Listening Lab. Thanks for having us in this incredible facility.
Amen.
But I wanted to ask about the evolution of Willie Mitchell's sound and Ovie Wright being an interesting case study for it because he didn't finish out his records with High. With y'all behind him, there was, as we got closer to the 70s, late 70s and the early 80s, a synthesized, more electronic sound came about, and the band was different band, a different sound, different feel. I think of records like, That's the one with the lollipop in front. That pink record, that's a good record.
No,
it's funky.
I really didn't do that.
What was it like seeing that end of that high record Cream era and then the Waylo era as Willie began to incorporate and adopt synthesizers and something that was different from the sound that y'all had put together with him?
Well, see, Herbie, Willie's stepson, that's all he wanted to do anyway was to play a synthesizer. But he was a hell of a piano player. But he just...
He played in, like, Quo Jr. and some other, like, some punk rock bands, too. I mean, he was far out.
He had a rock group, Quo Jr. and Black Rock was his last group. And when he got with High Rhythm, because you're even in the military, so Willie wanted a piano player. So I said, Herbie's back home. He said, oh, man, Herbie's not going to do right. I said, yeah, he will. He said, no, man, that's my boy. He said, he ain't going to do right. I said, Willie, I promise you. So he said, okay, go and talk to him, and we'll see. So I called him, and he said, yeah, man, I come. Because that's all he was talking about when he was overseas. He was here and tired of being alone, wanted to get back with the group. So when he first came back with the group, High Rhythm did a gold record with Willie Mitchell. Our very first gold of a soul serenade. Herbie wanted to play synthesizer. I said, y'all excuse me. I said, hell no. I said, I want you to play the piano. He said, oh, man, I said, play the piano, please.
He already was doing right.
He wasn't
doing
right.
You doing funny, he don't do right.
Willie told me, so I told you he gonna act right. I said, yeah, Will. I said, Herbie, come on, play the piano. He said, okay, I'll play the piano. And that was our first gold record.
Well, the OV Wright track that I'm thinking of is We're Still Together. And that album, We're Still Together, I mean, it's post-disco. It's beyond disco. How did it feel with the High Rhythm, Willie Mitchell partnership on record to come to an end in the later 70s and the early 80s and being displaced by this new sound? It was sweeping all genres, but it impacted Memphis Soul as well.
Yeah. Well, that's why we work. If you notice Al Green, when we first started recording him, the sound just changed. We tried to keep up with, what is going on, you know. And if you are a musician, you should pay attention. I was in a setting with Quincy Jones, and he made it very clear, a good musician to learn how to play all type of music because things change. And if you want to continue to be a part of it, you have to, kind of get in that flow with it. But that album, that's one of the greatest albums.
And again, another testament to how versatile Obie Wright was, that he could make that adjustment.
He's awesome.
Well, let's get into side B. How about that?
Man could possibly want. like a gust of wind.